wonders of aviation. Take to the skies in Wings. Suit up, strap yourself in, check your instruments, and you're cleared for takeoff. The mission? To match wit and weapons against enemy MiGs. Hunt them out, cut them down, and take the ride of your life. Great Plains, the F-86.
Hi there, and welcome to Random Access Television, the podcast where we discuss a TV show that's been picked for us at random by our vintage supercomputer that we fed the name of every TV show in existence into. My name is Zach, alongside my co-host Nos. Join us as we watch whatever the computer has spit randomly out for us this week. This time around, it's Wings, the hilarious adventures of the crew of Sandpiper Airlines at... No, wrong show. It's not Wings the sitcom, it's Wings the Discovery Channel show that ran at the same time and was about as popular. This one's about planes. Nos, had you ever watched Wings before this?
I had not, but what you're telling me is there were two shows on at the same time called Wings?
Yes.
But if you were saying to your friend or coworker or family member, hey, Martha, take it easy, I'm going to go home and watch Wings, how would they know which one?
I know, and they ran at the same time. I've seen so many, I remember seeing so many TV guides where it was
Wings
on the USA Network and Wings on the Discovery Channel, and they were completely different shows.
That's so weird. That's so strange.
They even have very similar logos.
Right. That's what when the computer first suggested Wings, I was like, okay, well, I think I've heard of this before. And then you're like, well, it's a documentary style show. And I'm like, I don't think I have.
Well, let's get into a little documentary about the documentary. So we're looking at Wings. Again, not the sitcom of the same name, but in this case, the documentary series that aired on the Discovery Channel. The focus of each episode was generally about a single make and model of an airplane, almost exclusively, but not exclusively, military planes. It aired from 1988 to sometime in the mid-90s, or 2002, or 2008, depending on your perspective. So why the confusion? We'll get into that a little bit later. But mainly it's because Wings isn't really a TV show at all, at least not in the traditional sense.
Yeah.
So some backstory here. At the time, most cable TV channels, especially the Discovery Channel, didn't produce a lot of their own content. Their airwaves were full of reruns of American-produced documentaries from sources like Jacques Cousteau or National Geographic, and also a ton of foreign content, especially from the UK, Canada, Australia, and other English-speaking countries that they could just acquire, edit to allow for commercials, and just air. As an aside, by the way, cable channels at the time used to also need a lot more content, because unlike today, where they show giant 4 to 12-hour blocks of the same show, back then most channels didn't repeat a show more than once, if at all, during the course of a day, so they needed a lot more different shows to air. So the first series of episodes was titled Great Plains, and it was produced in Australia. I can't confirm this, but I suspect not specifically for the Discovery Channel, but for broadcasts in Australia and elsewhere. The Discovery Channel just picked it up, and other than adding an American intro, it just aired it as is. And it's from this initial batch of episodes that the first episode that we watched came from. It was written and narrated by its producer Luke Swan, and it was titled, and about, the North American F-86 Sabre Fighter Jet. Nos, what did you think?
Okay, Zach. Well, I'm gonna have to admit, so this show, I think you could definitely qualify the show as sort of ASMR. Like, if you yes. want to go to sleep, put this on and you will be out within by the end of it.
In the few weeks that we've since I first watched an episode of this, I've multiple times put on a playlist of YouTube episodes of this and fallen asleep to it.
So this first episode, I tried so hard to finish it, and I fell asleep 3 separate times. And I'm gonna, these two episodes were probably, thus far, with all the shows that we've watched, these have been the two hardest ones to get all the way through. I love documentaries. I love weird esoteric knowledge. Mm-hmm. But for some reason, I don't know if it's like the vaguely, I guess he's an Australian narrator. Mm-hmm. or just the very clinical kind of textbook way that he's reading these, I can't make it through without falling asleep, which is very weird for me.
Yeah, it's really bad. And I'm not usually somebody who falls asleep to these things. And I watch these things, I mean, not like late at night or anything. I watch these things like peak afternoon, you know.
Right.
The first time I watched it, it was noon. It was, you know, I was eating lunch and it was just so sleepy. Just as a narration, just as an example here, I'm going to play a clip of his narration about the engine of the F-86.
At the heart of the P-86 was a General Electric J-47 jet engine, which utilized the axial flow principle, like that used in the earlier German ME-262, but now more sophisticated and refined. The jet concept worked on the principle of air being drawn in from the air intake on the nose of the aircraft, then passed into an axial flow compressor area, where the air is progressively compressed through 12 different stages. It is then forced into the combustion chambers, where atomized fuel is injected and the mixture is then ignited. The resulting combustion and expansion of exhaust gases provides the thrust necessary and also drives the compressor so that the cycle continues.
All right, audience, if you're still awake...
because I am not...
Yeah, you can now totally just sense exactly what we're talking about. That music is kind of like a Casio demo button kind of music. Very 80s, with just long stretches of music with planes flying and occasionally some like subdued like machine gun noises underneath.
Right. Like very, it's just, you know, old documentary footage. You know, it kind of almost reminded me of the Crayon Factory episode of Mr. Rogers, except for not as nice. It was like it was like that, but kind of with more war. So instead of like all the pretty colors like stacking on top of each other, it's just plane, loading bombs, plane, landscape.
Yeah, and this first episode, it didn't even have any talking heads, like anybody like saying, well, this is why I made this plane this way or something like that. There was nothing of that. It was just, here's them describing why the plane switched from this type of machine gun to a different kind of machine gun, or why this particular one has a swept wing design as opposed to a cab forward design.
I mean, God bless, you know, the dads and grandpas who sat and watched this, who were totally riveted.
And here's the thing. I know I watched this when I was younger. I know that my dad and I sat around and watched this. Usually, you know, they would have like a Discovery Channel at the time was had kind of like theme nights, I believe. So it'd be like this and then like World at War or a World War One documentary or some other war-like documentary. And that was the night we would watch because my dad is a dad. Mm-hmm. And, you know, World War II documentaries are kind of our thing. So
right. And I mean, right there, that's the thing. Like World War II stuff. I love World War II stuff. I am getting my PhD in World War II-esque stuff. And but this is a part of it that just completely loses me. This seems like someone describing the, like, if somebody read an IKEA manual out loud.
Like, yeah, it's almost that bad, at least for this first one here. I'm just, you know, the other thing I noticed, because I almost have, you know, usually I have paragraphs of notes, but I could read you my notes right here. It does a real passive anodyne voice when it comes to killing. I could easily fall asleep to this and almost did. It really doesn't explain a lot and assumes some military knowledge already. That's it. Those are the only notes that I had.
Right. It doesn't cover any of the sociological or even historical concepts of war.
This particular jet was used during the Korean War.
Right.
And they kind of say for a brief time, like on a military thing, they kind of say, like, it was used to shoot down this particular plane or this one particular mission happened. But it's almost as if the planes didn't even have pilots.
Right.
Like, they just kind of, like, exist in this world of them own, of their own.
Yeah, yeah. No, actually, it's interesting that you mentioned that, both this and the second episode, which we'll talk about in a second. It exists almost in this world of, I think, it reminds me of how a lot of people talk about 1950s nostalgia in the way that they remember pieces of it that are totally removed from how reality was.
Right.
It's like, oh, you know, remember how you used to be able to go to the soda fountain and get, you know, ice cream for 5 cents? Well, yeah, that's true, but it's totally devoid of an actual lived experience.
Right. And this doesn't even have, like, the lived experience of the pilots or the people who made it. There's almost no human beings in this whatsoever.
No, no, it's very mechanical. It's very... clinical. It just seems like you're just reading a manual. And I'm fascinated with the fact that there were so many episodes made.
Yes. Yes. I'll get into that more, but a little bit here. Actually, might as well, because there's not much else to say about this first episode. Yeah, exactly what it is. The second one and further ones have more interesting stuff. So let's get into that. So, relative to basic cable ratings of the late 80s, this was a pretty big hit for the Discovery Channel.
So wild.
A second batch called Strange Planes, also made, produced by the same Australian company, aired in 1990, and that might have been it. But then the Gulf War happened. So that war was mostly won by air power, and the show really caught on.
Interesting.
The Discovery Channel then started to do two things. First, it re-edited the old Great Plains episodes and retitled them as Wings, and would throw in interviews with the pilots, including some very famous ones like George H.W. Bush and Bob Dole. Oh. And then they also started to produce their own episodes as well. But while they were waiting for those to be finished, they took whatever documentaries about military aircraft they could find from various origins, various runtimes, they slapped the name Wings on them, put the same time slot in there, and then ran them.
Okay.
So that ran until 1992, when the first American-produced series, and possibly the kind of the peak of this show, Wings Over the Gulf, aired, using like the stealth bomber and the A-10 and the various things that were used in the first Gulf War. Then after that would become the first of what ended up being many miniseries within the series, which was the 1992 series Wings of the Luftwaffe, which I probably just mispronounced horribly, one of which, the episode about the FW-190 fighter plane was the second episode we watched for the pod. This one was a lot more interesting to say, at least on some levels. Go ahead.
Yeah, this one was interesting not for the subject matter. Again, it was extremely clinical, like reading a manual. However,
I do got to say, before we get anything else, the British narrator had a little bit more class and energy to him.
Yes.
And this one had... interviews with people in there and like some things about the guy who designed it and like how it was to fly. It had a little, because there's a lot of Nazi stuff we're about to get into, but I just wanted to say this ahead of time, it was a little bit more human as far as things go,
right? Which is
not
always,
much.
I would venture to say human in a way. You know, again, we're going to be talking about Nazi stuff, so everybody just gear up. If it makes you uncomfortable, please, you know, we won't be offended if you turn us off here. But you know, this one had interviews with a Luftwaffe pilot, and you know, one of his main talking points was piloting this was a lot of fun. Which, you know, is kind of de rigueur for this style of show. It's very depersonalized. I would venture to say it's not exactly patriotic or jingoistic, though there are elements of that in there. It's just very detached from any kind of reality.
So I'm going to go ahead and play a clip. I pulled a clip of the pilot talking. Here it is. It's very brief.
The Russians didn't have any experience. The pilots were not trained in tactics. They flew very obsolete equipment, maybe from the Spanish War. The main bulk of their fighter fleet was the J-16 Rata, is the nickname, and the J-153, a biplane.
So you can hear his kind of enthusiasm for, in this particular case, shooting down Russian planes that were much older and worse.
Right. And there was definitely, I thought that was very interesting in this episode, how they very much cast the Russians as an other. So, for instance, it was okay for violence to be enacted toward them because it was an othering.
Well, yeah. And this was a a U.S.-produced documentary, mm-hmm. and they barely mentioned American mm-hmm. planes in this at all. Mm-hmm. And the two different pilots that they did were from the Eastern Front.
Right.
And all the footage they showed of these planes shooting down planes was from the Eastern Front. I'm sure that they had planes of them shooting down American bombers Absolutely. And just didn't choose to use it. Now, and on the other hand, the depersonalization of this, I'd almost say that this thing was almost denazified.
Absolutely. Couldn't agree more. They literally don't
say the word Nazi or Hitler mm-hmm. at any point in the entire documentary.
That's very true. However, I did notice that they used, I'm forgetting her name, the famous Nazi.
Oh, Riefenstahl.
Thank yeah. you. They used some clips of hers, and they did use Ride of the Valkyries as the mm-hmm. background track. So it was all these, like, what we would consider dog whistles now, but I, you know.
So there was one where, when I'm writing down clips mm-hmm. And I'm watching the episodes, I'm like, okay, write down 132 American intro, 22 right. minutes Korean War.
Right.
This clip I'm about to play you, I wrote down 5 minutes and 30 seconds. Hitler is good?
Right.
Now, please don't take right. that out of context. That was me being sarcastic, because listen to this.
In 1937, the war was still distant, and Germany reveled in its newfound prosperity. The Third Reich had brought order and a renewed sense of national pride to a nation that had suffered harsh treaty conditions after the First World War, followed by a cruel depression. Now there was purpose. There was also planning. Planning for a new Germany with wider borders, and planning for a new Luftwaffe.
And if you listen to that and don't hear kind of a propaganda
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
that, like, oh, the Allies were very mean to the Germans, and now that their economy is going again, they could make more of this plane.
Right. And this brings me into something that I am going to bring up, because it's very much my area of expertise. So I want to kind of talk a little bit about how, for some of our younger listeners that may not know it, in 1992, Schindler's List was released in a worldwide, and that made a huge difference on how Americans and the world at large looked at Nazis and the Nazi phenomenon.
Mm-hmm. And the German people in general.
And the German people in general.
I'm a guy who grew up watching a lot of World War II movies and reading documentaries, and when the Holocaust would come up, and it wouldn't come up very often, this was a different thing.
Yep.
These Nazis were different people, and the Germans, especially the soldiers, were just as good or whatever as us.
Absolutely.
I saw as many documentaries about Rommel, for instance, mm-hmm. the German general, as I did for, you know, an American general, because
right.
he was one of those not quote-unquote Nazis.
Exactly. There was not the post Schindler's List. Mm-hmm. We got this idea of kind of a very patriotic us versus them, in the way that Nazis are these mythical, evil, scheming, devilish people. And while I think there is a place for that narrative, it's almost overcorrecting for the depersonalization and detachment mm-hmm. of some of these earlier documentaries. Where...
Right, so they made him from the most anodyne, boring people in
right.
the world to cartoon villains.
Exactly.
And they were neither. They were, right,
exactly.
people like us.
Exactly.
But and it... that's hard to explain, and especially in a documentary about a fighter plane.
Right, which ends up, and that's what's interesting about this episode, not because of the content was boring as shit. Whoops.
Yes.
Bleep that out. But it is kind of, it's so clinically historical that it loops around and becomes ahistorical, because
mm-hmm.
it's so not cognizant of the lives that were at stake, of the people who suffered, of the enormous, you know, just destruction that World War II had, not just in Germany, not just in England, but just in the world as a whole.
Right.
So it's very fascinating to me how our idea, I don't think that something that is this cold and clinical would be made about Nazis today.
No, definitely not.
It just would.
And so out of pure curiosity, so both of these I noticed that we watched were about fighter planes. So fighter planes, if you don't know much about military, fighter planes only generally shoot down other planes.
Right.
They don't bomb people on the ground. They don't bomb civilians. So I was curious, so I started flipping through one about the American B-29 bomber, which was the primary bomber used to bomb the cities of Japan, including with the nuclear bombs, at the end of World War II. And that one, while the first half was boring technical specs, I watched it to the end, and it's still trying to be detached, but at the same time, it at least acknowledged it.
Yes.
Like, there was a horrific thing, and it was actually destroyed more of it than the famous bombs at Hiroshima and Nagasaki. There was a firebombing of Tokyo.
Right.
And the first times it's mentioned in the most technical way possible, as they mentioned how many square acres were burned to the ground.
Right.
But 5 minutes later, at the conclusion of that segment, they do talk about the lives lost, the people homeless and everything. But then they go back to kind of like a big picture. Then the nation was starved. And it's like, well, what does that mean? Doesn't matter. We're going on to the next thing.
Right.
We're going to talk about the commander. It was also a bit more human focused. And then it also talked about how difficult it was to fly the plane, how difficult it was when they crashed, the, you know, some sympathy for the American bombers. And even at one point, a segment on the Chinese workers who were building a railroad and everything like that. I guess they had to make gravel by using tiny rocks to make gravel for an air for an airstrip.
That's interesting. Yeah, that I mean that kind of stuff is like a lot more in is a lot more. At least it's an attempt at being a little bit more human centered and humanistic.
With a fighter plane, you can just be whatever. It's a military thing fighting against other military thing. But when you're, you know, bombing women and children, you have to at least acknowledge it. And I got the feeling this one in particular, it wasn't the original Australian crew. It was an American redubbing.
Interesting.
Of one of the Australian documentaries, one of the ones that they included interviews with pilots and everything. And in this particular case, they showed a lot of footage of the crew of the Enola Gay, the plane that dropped it on Hiroshima.
Right.
But the clips that they used weren't him later on showing, you know, respect for the dead or showing... He never really showed remorse, the captain of the United.
No, he didn't. He didn't. I've seen so many interviews with him, and he was never. He was always like, "Well, I did what I did, and I don't have any regrets."
But the images that they chose to use in this, the pictures or not pictures, the video was propaganda from very shortly after the bombing. But then they would contrast that to pictures of, you know, devastation on the ground, but again, devastation with no human beings in it, because this is like a G-rated war documentary somehow, and they used to try to do that, and I don't know if that's possible, especially in a war as bloody as World War II. What I have a theory about with the Nazi thing is not that I think that anybody involved with this had Nazi leanings or white nationalist leanings or anything, but I think it's protagonist bias.
Yeah.
When you're making a documentary about a thing, it's hard not to make that thing the good guy.
Yeah.
And it's hard to think of that thing, whatever that thing is, as something that is bad. And if you are really into airplanes, like at one point they show this guy who remade this German Nazi plane, like by hand.
Right.
He made a physical, this American guy in the 80s, in Arizona, physically made by hand, a recreation of the plane.
Yeah, yeah.
And you can just tell from him that if you asked him, like, were you sympathetic to the Nazis or the Germans or anything like that? And he would probably be aghast at that.
Right, right.
It wouldn't even occur to him.
Right. And then it goes back to, again, my area of study, which is a lot of times, whether it means to be or not, even, you know, Holocaust survivor... you know, films and media and things like that can end up being unintentionally perpetrator centric. And I think it's something that we kind of as a society, we sort of expect in many ways. But on the other hand, there's other ways to do it. And I think this is a very good example of the pre-90s perpetrator-centric without specifically meaning to be, but not necessarily considering, you know, what if we chose a little bit of a different way to do this?
Right. Like, and trying to be so neutral, you end up picking a side. It's the same sort of thing with a lot of, not to get political here, but a lot of journalism nowadays or not nowadays, for all time.
All time, yeah.
But has tried to become, when you become so neutral to it, to try to become so neutral, you end up picking the more aggressive side by default.
Right. We see this a lot of times in like New York Times, you know, like headlines where it's trying to look at something objectively and ends up being completely bonkers.
Right. Because you whatever side is yelling the loudest is going to get the biggest quotes, regardless of whatever morals you choose to do it with. And that's about as political as we're going to get on this show. So anyways, so do you have anything more to say? Or?
Well, I'm going to give you a little Luftwaffe trivia.
Okay.
So because this is my favorite awful fact. Mm. So one of the most famous Luftwaffe interrogators named Hans Scharf was, he lived through the war. He got out unscathed as things go. And he was later invited by the U.S. Army to give interrogation lectures to U.S. soldiers. Mm-hmm. But he did not keep his calling as this interrogation master. He later found, he took up mosaic art.
Oh.
And he is the artist who designed the mosaic on Cinderella's castle in Walt Disney World.
Oh. Okay, good for him, I guess.
Well, you know, if you like Nazi art on your Walt Disney stuff, then Hans Scharf is your man.
Yeah. We can slander the dead. Yeah. Anyways. So, after Wings of the Luftwaffe, the series continued on with a series of miniseries. It was one about Soviet aircraft, one about the Vietnam War, one about experimental aircraft, seaplanes. You get the idea. So, it did this every few years until the late 90s when the Discovery Channel expanded out to a new channel called, drumroll, the Discovery Wings Channel. Yes, it was so popular, they dedicated an entire channel to it.
No, it's because people sleep to it, because people have to sleep.
I guess, but here's the thing. It wasn't just the one series, of course, but it was originally dedicated 100% to just aviation and space documentaries, going so far as to have a weather segment at the top of each hour just for pilots. So, of course, it couldn't just keep running reruns of its flagship show, so a new subset, Clash of the Planes, aired in 1999, and so on and so forth. Eventually, though, and this is just an opinion, I couldn't find anything specific on it, but the very small subset of people who would watch this kind of thing ran its course. And then after 9/11 and the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan started, it increased interest in more current military documentaries, not just World War II stuff. So it was renamed the Military Channel in 2005. Oh. And then later in 2014, the American Heroes Channel, where they could be even more nonspecific. But they still currently air three different shows where the title starts with the word Nazi. And this is my favorite. I was looking at a list of all the shows on there. It'd be like American Mafia, Mafia stuff. It's basically generic tough guy military stuff. But my favorite show is simply called Hitler.
Right. Yes, I have watched Hitler. I have absolutely watched Hitler. And again, it's what I said before, is this stuff ends up trying to be so historical that you just loop around and become very perpetrator centric.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, obviously the show's called Hitler, so no duh. But
it becomes sympathetic to its protagonist, regardless of whether it wants to or not.
Exactly.
All right, so this is our review time here. We will give the shows a review. This one was very difficult to review. We do it on the standard A to F scale. Yeah. I'm just going to go first. I'm going to give them both a C-, and I'll tell you why. So for Roger Ebert, my favorite critic of anything of all time, when he was reviewing the David Cronenberg film Crash.
Oh, my God.
Which is about people who crash their cars and then have sex in them. He said, "I do not have this fetish." Thus, I did not enjoy this movie. But if I did, this is the greatest movie that could have possibly existed due to this fetish. And I feel that way about Wings. I do not care about the inside designs of airplanes. But if I did, this would be the perfect show for that.
I love that you drew the analogy between this and Crash, because Crash is absolutely one of my favorite movies of all time. However, I completely echo everything you have said. I have no interest in this. This does not do it for me. This does not turn me on. This is not, you know. So yeah, C minus on both. And I think the only thing that I could say is that if you happen to love very cold manual type readings of things and you need to sleep, definitely put this on.
Yeah, this is a great show for that. And most of the episodes, the 90s and 80s ones, are on YouTube, including the two that we watched. If you felt like having a nice nap, on our Random Access playlist on YouTube, just search for it and it's right there.
Yeah.
It is time to fire up our computer here and see what the next thing is. All right, let's get this thing. Get the cards. All right, way. Okay, there we go. Whoa. Okay, I don't even know where to start with this one. Wow. Okay, well, the current number one entertainment show on television and one of the longest running shows on television, Saturday Night Live.
Oh.
I guess I'll just pick an episode at random and then
Seen the first season many times and I love it. So you might want to, you have to hit me with something a little bit more random.
Yeah. I've seen every episode since 2002, except for the Elon Musk episode. So, let's pick.
No.
Yeah. Let's let the computer pick again. Oh, okay. It has picked from season 17, episode 4, the Halloween episode from 1991, hosted by Christian Slater with the Smashing Pumpkins as the musical guest.
Oh, I am stoked. I am stoked. I am so excited.
That is the episode we'll watch. The whole episode is, I believe, on Peacock, though without the Smashing Pumpkins, so we can probably find those elsewhere. Go ahead and watch that on Peacock for free.
I will especially watch those. I love you, Billy.
Season 17, episode 4, Christian Slater hosted, and we will see y'all next time.
Thanks for tuning into this episode of Random Access Television, and if you haven't already, please remember to subscribe to us on Apple and Spotify podcasts. We also love to read reviews, so go ahead and leave us one. You can find us at RATVPod, that's RATVPOD, at twitter.com, and if you have questions, complaints, compliments, recipes, email us at ratvpod@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you. Bye-bye.